It's business time, baby.
You are listening to Solo Monster Sounds Off.
It's such good shit.
Mama Monster.
Conquered. I'm home.
You're like fighting a woman?
You're saying Vince McMahon is stupid. Is that what you're saying?
Oh, my God. We're only an hour in.
Eric Bischoff is an idiot.
We have 2 more hours of this.
Maybe the single stupidest idiot that ever got into wrestling.
Who writes this stuff? Bruce?
Come over here and threaten me.
I'm the Solo Monster, damn it.
Is there a dumber wrestler on the planet than Michael Elgin? This guy was a rising star, Big Mike, right? Working for multiple promotions. He was a champion in Ring of Honor. He was a champion in New Japan. He was literally a champion right now in Pro Wrestling NOAH. The only promotion willing to give him another chance because nobody else would touch him. Impact fired him after allegations were made against him during the whole speaking out movement a couple of years ago. All the stories about him just generally being a shitty human being. I know last year he was arrested for violating an order of protection that his ex-fiance took out against him. So NOAH gives him a chance to revive his dead career. They make him one half of their tag team champions. And then this week, NOAH announced that the tag team titles had been vacated because Elgin was unable to compete on their Friday show. And nobody knew why. I think he may have missed a couple of shows this week. Nobody knew why until yesterday when Cassidy Haynes of BodySlam.net broke the story that the reason for Elgin's absence is because he was arrested last weekend in Japan for stealing protein powder. He was caught shoplifting. I don't know what NOAH is paying its talent these days, but if they can't afford protein powder, then something is very wrong. Theft is something they take very seriously over there. You know, Matt Sydal was arrested in Japan 6 years ago for having 2 grams of liquid cannabis on him. He spent a month, might have been a month or two, in jail over there because he couldn't even get a court date set for about 8 weeks. And they wanted him to serve 18 months. That's what the prosecutor wanted. But he worked out a deal where he got 3 years probation and he got the hell out of there. He says he's still traumatized. Whenever somebody asks him about what happened over there in Japan when he got busted, he's still traumatized by the whole experience. They're very strict about that kind of stuff also, especially with the drugs and everything. That's even worse. So that's Elgin's bigger concern right now. But in the ring, this dude is done. This dude is done. He's running out of countries to find work. This was his chance at a career revival. He wanted so badly to work in Japan again. Oh, I love Japan. I love the Japanese people. And they gave him a chance. And now one half of their tag team champions gets busted for shoplifting protein powder. It's a hell of a way to end a career. Not exactly going out in a blaze of glory. This is episode 765 of the Solo Monster Sounds Off for Sunday, July 17th, 2022. The flagship. I am the Solo Monster. This week, I am going to talk about all the hubbub about WWE Raw possibly going TV-14 again. I hate to rain on everyone's parade and be the party pooper, but somebody needs to inject some reality into this conversation. That's why I'm here. That's why you listen to me. I've got the latest on how much it's going to cost to book Sasha Banks to appear at your convention. People are losing their minds over this. These are the same people who do not understand how business works. The G1 climax is here. I've got my predictions. And I watched the first episode of the new WWE Rival show on A&E covering the feud between Bret Hart and Shawn Michaels. And I really wanted to like it. But it was ruined by the usual revisionist WWE history. So we have to set the record straight on a few things this week. And I'll even share a few details about things that you may never have even known about if you didn't read either of their books. But they did something during the special that really did a disservice to the viewers. So we'll get into all that this week. Check out the Jon Moxley audiobook. A lot of you have already cashed in your free trial for Audible using our link. It is still active, audibletrial.com/solomonster. Get yourself one free audiobook. Mox seems to be the popular choice. Jon Moxley narrating his own audiobook. Talking about his time on the indies, his time in WWE. A lot of good stuff in that book. And if you are an Amazon Prime member, you get two free books, I believe, when you use our link. Two for one. So audibletrial.com/solomonster. I don't know how much longer I'll be able to offer that, but that is available for you right now. If you want to make a PayPal donation, you may do so on the solomonster.com. You'll see the PayPal button at the top of the link tree. $10 or more will get you a nickname and a shout out like these fine folks here. I want to say thank you before we go any further to the Portland pop star Paul Hamilton, Ms. Madness, Michelle Mills, Night Stalker, Naif Al-Safar, Big B, Brian Becerra, Beast Mode, Brock Joseph, the Chicago Slayer, Willie Eichard, Velvet Revolver, Robert Murray, the Diamond Dallas Dance Machine, Harrison Soep, Killshot, Keith Hart, New York Punk, Arnold Modesto, John Raging Mad Riffle, Caleb Showtime Lindley, Iowan Corn Farmer, Jesse Lampier, Sherrod Big Daddy Boyd, Shin Superkick Akuma, and adorable Alex Hall. You can check out his YouTube channel, Echo Vision, where he makes custom WWE 2K22 stories with two original characters and two current wrestlers in a connected type of universe inspired by the MCU. Just search Echo Vision, that's E-K-K-O Vision, on YouTube, and it should be the first thing that comes right up. Speaking of 2K22, if you missed it, My Rise Episode 7 with yours truly hit the YouTube channel earlier this week. Well, Episode 8, you're not going to have to wait very long for it, because this week there'll be another brand new Sound of Gamer. And you can find that on my YouTube channel. So a lot of good 2K22 content out there. But let's get into this top story here. On Thursday, Andrew Zarian of the Matt Men podcast dropped some interesting news that starting July 18th, which is tomorrow, for those who don't know, WWE Raw will have a TV-14 rating moving forward on USA Network. The PG era is over, is what he declared on Twitter. Now, Monday Night Raw used to be a PG-rated show up until 1997, when it shifted to TV-14, and it's stayed that way until July of 2008. That was the birth of what people refer to as the PG era, which is kind of silly if you think about it, because the product was already PG for 20 years before that. But then later on that same day, Zarian posted an update and said, well, not so fast. Said, this is a wild situation. There's a lot happening behind the scenes. WWE Raw won't be going to TV-14 on July 18th, but it is still in consideration for a later date. There was a memo within USA Network that went out this morning regarding Raw changing to TV-14 on July 18th. Apparently, that was sent out prematurely, and the day was not finalized. So the latest is this. There was a memo sent out internally within USA Network about Raw moving to TV-14. And it looks like it went out earlier than it was supposed to. So it is very likely that the change is going to happen. It's just not going to happen tomorrow night. Now, over the years, I've heard people cite the Benoit murder-suicide as the reason for WWE shifting to a PG product, and you know, it may have played a small role in the company wanting to clean up its image and eliminate, you know, chair shots to the head and things of that nature. But the move to PG was happening whether or not Chris Benoit killed himself and killed his family. That happened a full year before they went PG. And I think people give too much credit to that as being the real catalyst to all this. The main reason the company went PG is because earlier that same year, in February of 2008, WWE signed a multi-year agreement with Mattel, which was, and I believe may still be, the biggest toy manufacturer in the world, okay? Mattel makes Barbie, they make Matchbox cars, Fisher-Price, okay? Huge company, that's all Mattel. WWE had been working with Jax Pacific for many years, and they ended up suing Jax over some alleged bribery scheme involving the video game license. It was a whole mess. It went on for years. So how awkward was that, right? They had to work together for X number of years while they were suing them in court. But they kept working together on their various toy lines and the action figures and whatnot because they had a contract. Later on, though, they awarded their toy license to Mattel. That was 1 year before the agreement with Jax expired. They already went and announced that our next big toy maker is going to be Mattel. And Jax ended up working with TNA on their own line of action figures. But they signed that deal with Mattel in early 2008. That summer is when they took the product PG. And that, more than anything else, had to do with them making that change. They had made certain promises to the Mattel folks about what they would and would not do on their television shows. Because you can understand, if you're an executive with a major toy company, right, you manufacture toys for children. And WWE wants to do business with you, and you want to do business with them, but you have some reservations when you put the TV on and you watch the product as it used to be during that time period, you know, even into 2007, 2008, you're going to have some reservations. You're going to want some promises made, I think, before you jump into bed with these people. And I guess whatever WWE promised them, they were comfortable with that, and so that was kind of part of the whole agreement. That was part of the whole arrangement that they made together. So there were certain promises made. They're still working with Mattel today, so I doubt there would be any major noticeable changes to the type of content that they allow on their shows. And this is really why I think people need to temper their expectations for what this all means. Anyone throwing a party, you know, this is going to be the return of some kind of glory era of WWE programming, you're going to be massively disappointed. Again, I hate to be the bearer of bad news here, but I think people need to just cool their jets. When you think of the era of TV-14, WWE shows, what do you think of? What is the first thing that you think of, right? You probably think of the Attitude Era. You probably think of blood. You think of chair shots to the head. You think of cussing on live TV. You think of bra and panties matches and gravy bowl matches on Thanksgiving. How much of that do you honestly believe that you're going to start seeing on television? Here's a better question. I got an even better question for you. Why do you think any of that is going to make Raw a better show? They're never going to do blood on television the way that AEW does. If you're a big blood guy, they're never going to do it at the level that even an AEW does. AEW is like a fucking bloodbath every other week. We have a barbed wire death match on Dynamite this Wednesday. More blood. You're never going to see that on WWE television. We already see blood occasionally anyway. Usually it's hard way, but it's not as if we never see blood on WWE shows. Chair shots to the head are dead and buried, as they should be. Bra and panties matches, that doesn't exactly fit with the whole women's revolution stuff that they love to talk about. They just installed a woman as their interim CEO. Their former CEO is being investigated for hush money payments because he'll fuck anything that moves. And the Wall Street Journal is apparently working on another McMahon story that could drop any week now. So that story isn't going away. You know, tits and ass television is not suddenly going to make a comeback. I mean, it can't anyway, right? I mean, John Laurinaitis is the one with the subscriptions to all the swimsuit catalogs, and he's been placed on administrative leave. I mean, who are they going to get to do the recruiting for them? Then there's all the adult language. We had Brock Lesnar on Raw less than a week ago using the word shit-kicking. Or remember when he told Heath Slater, I don't give a shit about your kids. That was 6 years ago. Even if they bleeped it out, so what? He still said it. Lots of people have spit out four-letter words on Raw over the years, even in the PG era. And I love a well-placed four-letter word myself. I think it could be very effective, so long as it's not overused, like it is in AEW. I feel like every other promo, not even every other promo, every promo in AEW has the word shit in it. Jade Cargill's in the back for 30 seconds talking to Tony Schiavone. Tony, cut the shit. Right? We get that every week. Maybe that's why USA is doing this. They see what TBS and TNT allow with AEW, and they want to give WWE the same latitude on their show to be a little edgier. It's possible. But people need to quit pretending like the show You know, these shows have been My Little Pony or Sesame Street for the past 14 years. And we never see anything edgy and we never hear any kind of risque language. That's just not true. WWE programming was always considered PG all throughout the 80s. You know, when I first started watching, I was of that age, right? You had all the cartoon gimmicks and it was a very tame show for the most part, even into the early 90s. And that whole era, you know, the 80s, that's the golden era, right? That's what people call it. It's the golden era of WWE. It was always considered PG, even though actual, you know, the actual TV rating system in the U.S. actually wasn't even introduced until 1997. That's when we first started seeing the little black box in the corner of the screen that said TV PG or, you know, TV 14, or if you were a South Park fan, right? It was always TVMA for mature audiences. That whole system wasn't even introduced until 97. So, you know, when I say that it was a PG show, I don't mean literally, you know, they had a PG box in the corner of the screen when the show, you know, came on the air every week, because that system didn't actually exist. But it was basically a PG show. But some of my fondest wrestling memories and some of the best angles and some of the best stories came from a time when the product was a PG product. There was very little that would have been considered inappropriate for kids under the age of 13 back then. And then came the Attitude Era, where the language got a little edgier and the stories got a little edgier and then they got a lot edgier. And it was fun. I mean, I'm not going to lie. It was like a party every week, especially if you were there in the building live. You know, I was also a teenager by then, so I was right in that target audience that they were catering to. They didn't go PG for another decade. But you could already see years before that, the product, it just wasn't what it used to be. It was like this steady decline. They were still using edgy language. They were still coming up with these outrageous storylines. You know, the Katie Vick story. Kane and Lita and her miscarriage. Kurt Angle wanting to have bestiality sex with Booker T's wife. This is real shit that they did. That didn't make the shows any better. I mean, there was some pretty bad shit during that time period in the mid-2000s. You know, whatever the fuck Heidenreich did to Michael Cole that one time on SmackDown. Actually, Heidenreich said the idea came directly from Vince McMahon. Vince told him it came to him in a dream. How would you like to be trapped in a Vince McMahon dream? Not even Stephen King could write something so terrifying. But that's just a sample of some of the wonderful things that we got to see before the return to PG. Just to show you that it wasn't all good. Just because they didn't have the handcuffs on. But something you may not realize is that SmackDown has always been a TV PG rated show. Ever since the very first episode on UPN back in 1999, it's always been a PG show. And there have been some classic SmackDown moments over the years, some really good shit on SmackDown. And the rating in the corner of the screen had absolutely nothing to do with it. It came down to two things, the talent and the creative. When you have the talent that can deliver and the creative that supports them, you end up with great television. It's a very simple formula. Look at NXT. Just look at what they have done with NXT 2.0. They are trying to appeal to a younger demographic. So we get dick jokes and condom jokes. We've got close-up shots every week of Mandy Rose and her cleavage. We've got adult language. Andre Chase is saying the word fuck every week, even though they, you know, obviously they censor it. It's basically already a TV 14 show, but it says TV PG on the screen when the show comes on the air every week. But what difference would it actually make? How different could that show possibly be if they changed the rating? It's not going to make a lick of difference. All this talk about the rating is meaningless. And the reason that it is meaningless, the whole point of all this, is because no matter what happens, the same 76-year-old man is still running WWE Creative. Vince McMahon is still responsible for the creative direction of the show. And so long as Vince McMahon is responsible for the creative direction of the show, absolutely nothing will change. If anything, it could get worse, knowing his sense of humor. You know, Vince may leave one day and the shows could get worse. He may leave and the shows could improve and actually get better. But so long as he is still in that chair, so long as he is still ripping up scripts and rewriting them 2 hours before the show, you know, so long as the writers were putting together a show to appeal to him, as long as they're writing for an audience of one, I don't see how anybody could be excited about any of this. You are setting yourself up for disappointment. What are you doing? Don't do that. The belief is that this is a USA Network call. This is not a WWE call that USA has to approve. This is coming from the network. The network supposedly wants to make this change. And WWE will go along with whatever the network wants because they're the ones paying hundreds of millions of dollars every year to WWE for their content. I would like to remind you all about the significance of this month. This month marks the 10-year anniversary of Raw's permanent move to 3 hours every week. It was July of 2012. Raw 1000, right? That was the night CM Punk, I think, went heel and laid out The Rock at the end of the show, and DX beat up Damian Sandow at the beginning of the show. It was one big celebration. They did a huge number. I think that's still the biggest rating that Raw did, probably above a 5. It was in the 5 or 6 range. I mean, it did some ridiculous number. They haven't even come close to touching that ever since. But up to that point, they only had the occasional 3-hour show. If they did a King of the Ring gimmick, that show might be 3 hours, right? It was rare, but it did happen. But that was the first week where it went 3 hours permanently every single week. At that time, that was also said to be a USA Network decision. It was not something that WWE wanted to do. You know, writing 3 hours of television is not easy. And the show has lost viewers every year since. You know what the bigger change would be? If USA Network is so hell-bent on making a change to Monday Night Raw, the rating doesn't mean shit. The rating of the show doesn't mean shit. The bigger change, the better change, would be to scale Monday Night Raw back to 2 hours. Now, that's not likely to happen. USA still does its best numbers with Raw every week. I can't imagine they're going to want to cut the show down by an hour. And also, you know, making the show shorter doesn't mean the show is necessarily going to be better. SmackDown lately, I think, is proof of that. That's a 2-hour show. But it would force them to tighten the show up. There wouldn't be as many segments where it feels like they're just trying to eat up as much time as possible. So even a bad Raw would not be as bad because there's 60 minutes less of it to sit through. But at the end of the day, it comes down to the writing. The writing and the booking, those are two different things, by the way. Those are not the same thing. The writing and the booking, that's ultimately what it all boils down to. You want to change something for the better, that is the only change that USA Network should be considering. The latest on Sasha Banks and Naomi is that there is still nothing official on the status of Sasha Banks and Naomi. But Sasha got a lot of play on social media when C2E2, which is the Chicago Comic and Entertainment Expo, posted that she would be appearing at their convention next month for a signing and a photo session, and she was announced under her real name of Mercedes Varnado. Now, that in and of itself does not mean anything. It's an entertainment convention. She had a role in The Mandalorian, and she was credited under her real name. She was not credited as Sasha Banks. But a report from Fightful that broke this week is the strongest evidence yet that Sasha Banks is as good as gone from WWE. On Wednesday, the official C2E2 Twitter posted a message welcoming Mercedes, and they did put Sasha Banks in parentheses, welcoming Mercedes, and said, whether you've seen her in the ring or as Casca Reeves in The Mandalorian, you are not going to want to miss out on this photo and autograph opportunity. So she is going to be there on August 6th and August 7th. That's a Saturday and Sunday next month. She's not going to be the only wrestler at C2E2. Mick Foley will be there, Trish Stratus, Lita. They often have wrestlers that appear at these conventions. Sting, you know, I mean, some big names. They get to come to some of these conventions. I remember the first year that I went to Comic-Con and I had my press pass, which was a few years ago. Sting and Christian Cage were there. And the line for Sting was huge. You know, Sting was a big hit. I you know, could barely get over to where the guy was just to see what was going on. There were so many people over there. So she's not going to be alone. But what got people talking was a report from Fightful Select on her asking price for similar convention gigs. And from this, people have deduced that this is what she must be making by doing C2E2. Her asking fee is said to be $30,000. I'm assuming that's for the entire weekend and not each individual day. I mean, I could be wrong, but for the benefit of this segment, we'll say that she's getting 30 grand for the entire weekend. This has sparked a raging debate about whether or not she is worth that much money. This debate has been fierce. People are taking sides. It has gotten very heated. I know this is very uncommon for social media, but it has. It's gotten very heated. A lot of people think the woman is full of herself for thinking that she's even worth that much money. Ignoring the fact that one promoter told Fightful that the number was exactly as expected for a non-wrestling appearance given her popularity. Especially with all the interest in her after walking out with Naomi, people are still talking about Sasha. And she hasn't even been on television in 2 months. Another promoter told Fightful that they would be more than happy to book her at that rate. And they knew that they would make that much and more from having her on their show. They believe her demand should be high given how rabid her fan base is. And the fact that she has not been part of the convention scene before. This is all new. And as with anything new, at first you can expect there to be a lot of pent-up demand. This promoter also said that her rate is comparable to the going rate for Sting, with the only people more expensive being Hulk Hogan, Ric Flair, Bill Goldberg, and Shawn Michaels. The evidence that I was talking about that she is as good as gone from WWE is the fact that per Fightful, promoters were told that she was not taking pro wrestling related bookings until January 1st. Of 2023. That is the strongest sign yet that she's either gone or expects to be gone very soon, and her lawyers are just working out the terms of her release. You know, at C2E2, I went on the website to see how much the autographs and the photo ops are going for. Photo ops with Sasha are going for $90 a pop. Autographs are going for $70 a pop. Now, I don't know how the money is going to get divvied up between the convention and the photographers and anybody else who gets paid out of that. But if Sasha's getting a flat fee of $30,000, I mean, think about it like this. If they get 300 people willing to pay $90 to get a photo with Sasha Banks, and you know that's not going to be hard to do, that's almost $30,000 right there. If anything, I think she's underselling herself. I actually think she should be charging more money. You could sit there and say, who does she think she is that she would request the same rate as Sting? Because right now, Sasha Banks is more relevant than Sting is. And I understand Sting is still on television, or I'm almost inclined to call him Mr. Stink. I love it. Andrade has poisoned my mind. But yes, Mr. Stink is on television still every week. Sasha hasn't been on TV in 2 months, but right now, Sasha Banks is more relevant than Sting. And because that's the number her agents and her lawyers determined that people would be willing to pay to have her. That's why they came to the $30,000 figure. That's how they arrived at that number. They did not pull that number out of their ass. They did not pull that number out of thin air. They determined that this is the number people are willing to pay to bring her in. If there are promoters out there willing to pay $30,000 for Sasha Banks to come to their show and sit for photos and autographs for 3 or 4 hours, why wouldn't she ask for that amount of money? She's fresh off WWE television. She's one of the most popular, not even female stars, popular wrestling stars in the world. Full stop. One of the best women's wrestlers on the planet. Why wouldn't she ask for that amount of money? There's all this mystery behind her right now, where she's going to end up. Is she going to stay with WWE? Is she going to go to AEW? Is she going to go to Hollywood and leave wrestling altogether? What's she going to do? Whenever she makes that decision, it's Especially if, let's say, she ends up in an AEW. There's going to be a whole new wave of buzz around her. She could ask for even more money. I see nothing wrong with any of this. And I find it hilarious that some people are acting so appalled by this. It's like celebrities on Cameo. There are celebrities on Cameo. I was looking to get a Cameo shout out a while back for a friend for his birthday. Actually, one of the actors from Seinfeld, who had a minor role in the show. And honestly, I'm not even sure of what else he's ever done of any note in his career. But they were on there. They were on Cameo. My friend is a huge Seinfeld nut. I think the guy was asking for $175 for a shout out. I could be off by a little bit, but it was somewhere in that ballpark. I think it was about $175. And I just remember, I looked at that and I thought to myself, for this guy? Like, there are far bigger names on Cameo asking for half of what this person was asking for. But he was offering 24-hour turnaround, which not everybody does. And from the looks of his page, he was getting tons of requests. I was watching some of the sample videos, and he was getting tons and tons of requests. Other people, their going rate is $40. And I'm thinking to myself, why so low? People determine what they feel they're worth. If people are not willing to pay the money that you're asking for, then they'll have to reduce their fee. But if there are enough people willing to pay what you're asking for, it's supply and demand. A year from now, if she's off WWE television, maybe she isn't so hot anymore. Maybe people aren't talking about Sasha Banks anymore. But right now, she is, and I say good for her. I think she should be charging $50,000, to be perfectly honest with you. But that's the number that she and her team settled on. If they're wrong, she'll lower her fee. But it was funny reading all the comments from all the amateur business analysts this week on what fee Sasha Banks should be charging for her personal appearances. Remind me never to hire any of these people if I ever need an agent. Keith Lee and Swerve Strickland are the new AEW Tag Team Champions. They won the titles on Dynamite in a match with the Young Bucks, Ricky Starks, and Powerhouse Hobbs. Matt Jackson of the Young Bucks suffered a stinger during the match, and it was not on some wacky dive or some convoluted spot. He took a double suplex 4 minutes into the match from Lee and Hobbs. And it's just the way that he landed and his neck whiplashed. Sometimes it's the simple things. So you could see, if you go back and watch, you know, how he was holding his neck after that, I just assumed he was, you know, he was selling. I didn't think anything was wrong. He worked the rest of the match like you wouldn't think he suffered any kind of an injury. But it was a surprising finish. The Young Bucks had only just recently regained the tag team titles, and it looked like we were possibly heading for one last match, maybe it All Out, for all the gold between the Bucks and FTR. Meltzer says the plan all along was to get the belts on Lee and Swerve, and that they only did the tease of a split between the two to make it more of a surprise when they actually won the belts. If that's the case, it worked on me, because I was not expecting that finish. And I'm actually pretty happy about the fact that they're not splitting them up, because they're a hell of a team. And as busy as it is right now on AEW television, yes, I still think that Keith Lee, you know, the longer-term play for Keith Lee in particular is to go on and you know, be a major player in the singles division. But for the time being, being one half of the tag team champions and doing the deal with Swerve, it's not a bad place for him or Swerve to be in. So I'm kind of happy, actually, that they're not breaking them up. It was a hell of a main event. And when it was over, off the air, and they've since posted the video on the AEW YouTube channel, Keith Lee took the microphone. He addressed the cryptic tweet that he had posted earlier that day about some bad news that he had received. And it sounded like maybe it was about a family member, it was something personal. It was actually about a close friend of his that he's known for more than 20 years, who he had just found out has stage 4 colon cancer, which is a tough diagnosis. Doesn't get any worse than stage 4. But he dedicated his victory to them. He promised that he was going to get in his car and drive to Austin, Texas to be there with this person. Meltzer also says there's a major angle, a different major angle not involving FTR planned for the Young Bucks. He did not say what that big angle is. You know, before Kenny Omega went away, there were seeds planted for something with him and Adam Cole. That likely would have led, and it still might lead, to Kenny and the Bucks against Cole and Red Dragon. Well, Omega's still out. Still have no idea when he'll be back. Now Adam Cole is out. Kyle O'Reilly is also out with an injury. And Matt Jackson has a stinger. So it's the fucking walking wounded in this company right now. But it totally killed whatever the story was that they had planned. The update on Cole is that he is opting not to have surgery on his torn labrum. Instead, he's going to be continuing to do physical therapy to try to rehab it. He sounds like Kota Ibushi. Ibushi decided to heal his shoulder with rehab instead of surgery, and here we are 8 months later, and he claims he still can't do a single push-up. I hope that doesn't happen to Adam Cole. But the good news is that Cole is doing better after his concussion. That was the other injury issue he was dealing with coming out of the Forbidden Door show. But once you get all these guys back and healthy, and Bryan Danielson, he's another one, it'll be time to finally introduce those Trios belts. We know the Trios belts have already been made. Tony Khan is storing them away in his house, probably in one of his 24 rooms in his mansion somewhere. But there will be Trios titles, and when they start to get all these guys back and healthy, that's going to be the time to finally unveil them, because what we could have here is Kenny Omega and the Young Bucks challenging for the Trios titles, Adam Cole and Red Dragon challenging for the Trios titles. They've got the Blackpool Combat Club. They've got the Jericho Appreciation Society, the House of Black, Death Triangle, Best Friends, the Gun Club. You could put CM Punk and FTR back together. They were a team in that one match, so they have a lot of options where Trios titles are concerned, but I think maybe what Tony Khan is doing is he's waiting for people like Omega and Cole and Danielson to heal up and make their way back. Now this Wednesday on Dynamite, we have a barbed wire everywhere match, a death match with the Jericho Appreciation Society suspended above the ring in a shark cage because it's Shark Week. And the Warner executives wanted some tie-in with Shark Week, and this is what Tony Khan came up with. So it's going to be Chris Jericho against Eddie Kingston. Just because they're in the shark cage does not mean that one or all of them will not find their way out of the shark cage. Jericho is going into this match in his Painmaker persona, and he is undefeated as the Painmaker so far in AEW. He and Kingston had a match at Revolution back in March, and Kingston beat him. Kingston submitted Jericho using the stretch plum. I think Jericho gets the win this Wednesday. There's two things. Kingston said Jericho made him a liar at Blood and Guts when he said that he would taste Jericho's blood, and Jericho is one of the only ones, I think, who didn't bleed in the entire match. So this time, he wants to make him bleed. Well, it's a barbed wire match, so you know they're both going to bleed. It's a foregone conclusion. Kingston is going to get what he wants, but I think Jericho wins the match itself, because they could set Jericho up as the next challenger for Jon Moxley in the interim AEW world title. I don't know when CM Punk is coming back. I don't believe he's going to be out for too much longer, but we still don't have a timetable. We haven't heard anything. I would hope he's back in time for All Out when they go back to Chicago, but that's still 6 weeks away. You could do a Moxley versus Jericho match on TV before then, or if Punk isn't back in time, Jericho can be the failsafe, and you can make that your main event for All Out, the battle of the first two AEW world champions. So I think it's more important, actually, for Jericho to win this match than Eddie Kingston. Speaking of Chicago, they made it official this week. All Out on September 4th will take place at the Now Arena in Chicago. I was really hoping they'd do something bigger, you know, maybe their Canadian debut, maybe in Toronto, but they're staying in Chicago, and they're going to run the smaller venue. They're not running the larger United Center, even though I believe the building is available. Meltzer and The Observer said that it may be an issue of cost, since they're also running Dynamite and Rampage there that week. They can run all three shows in the same venue, which would have cost them a lot more to do that in the United Center. So it may have come down to simple economics, but they do so at the expense of an extra 5,000 to 7,000 people that they could have packed into that building. Tickets went on sale this week. The individual tickets, they went quickly. They are not sold out yet. They still have combo tickets available that will get you into all three shows that week. And those look like they are moving faster than they did for last year's show. So this whole combo offer, it looks like it's paying off for them, but they are not sold out yet. This Saturday is the second Ring of Honor pay-per-view under the Tony Khan regime, Death Before Dishonor, from Lowell, Massachusetts. In the U.S., it airs on Bleacher Report, and on traditional pay-per-view, the going price is $40. I will be live on YouTube after the show for the full review. It's a strong card. I was on the fence at first about it, but once they announced the tag team title match and the world title match, that put it over the top for me. So I'll be watching the show and going live when it's over. After his successful Ring of Honor world title defense on Rampage Friday night, Jonathan Gresham, he was met by Claudio Castagnoli, who will challenge him on Saturday for the Ring of Honor World Championship. This is the spot he was originally going to debut in before Bryan Danielson got hurt, and they needed Claudio for the Forbidden Door show. Claudio has history in Ring of Honor. They are pushing the fact that he has never been a world champion before. And when the night is over, we could have two members of the Blackpool Combat Club, each holding a world title. All we need now is Bryan Danielson to come back and challenge Jay White for the IWGP title. It feels like it would be too soon to get the belt off Gresham. Gresham has been on ice for so long. He's been the champion now for many months. But he's been on ice because there's been no Ring of Honor television. They had a pay-per-view back in April. They've had nothing since. So now they have this pay-per-view coming up. He just turned heel. He joined Tully Blanchard's new group. I would have to think that he holds on to the title a little bit longer, but I also think long-term the right move is to get that title on Claudio. He is the perfect person for that spot. Tony Khan is trying to relaunch Ring of Honor and get interest in the product, and I just think what better person Claudio, you know, he's again, somebody people know. All those years on WWE television, all those years of people saying this man is underappreciated, he's not valued for what he brings to the table, his talent is not being properly used. The guy is built like a fucking machine. He's a great performer, you know, bell to bell. He's one of the best that they have. What better choice as a representative, as your new Ring of Honor World Champion going into this new era of the company than somebody who spent all those years there, and as they said, has never been a world champion before. Now he has a chance to show people what he can do as the face of an actual brand, as the world champion for a company. He would be my choice for Ring of Honor World Champion. I think that's a great choice for a main event. But there is another match that they could headline with if they wanted to. That would be a worthy choice for the main event. FTR will defend their Ring of Honor tag team titles in a rematch from Supercard of Honor in April against the former champions Jay and Mark Briscoe. Best 2 out of 3 falls, which is a stipulation that both teams are no stranger to. The Briscoes have defended the Ring of Honor World Tag Team titles 4 times. In 2 out of 3 falls matches, FTR, back in their revival days, they've also taken part in 4 of them on TV. They've had 9 overall in their career. Their best and probably the most famous 2 out of 3 falls match they've had was the match against Johnny Gargano and Tommaso Ciampa at TakeOver Toronto in 2016. That is still one of the greatest tag team matches that I have ever seen. They filmed a sit-down interview segment with both teams, hosted by Caprice Coleman, that they posted on the AEW YouTube channel. It was tremendous. That is how you promote a match. I think FTR retained the titles, 2 falls to 1. Their first match is going to win a lot of Match of the Year votes at the end of this year, that first match they had back in April, these two teams. This one could top it. Now it's 2 out of 3 falls, like 2 matches in 1. This match could top the first match that they had. We also have Samoa Joe returning to defend his Ring of Honor television title against Jay Lethal. I think Joe retains. Mercedes Martinez defends her Ring of Honor Women's Championship against Serena Deeb. I think Mercedes keeps the title. And Wheeler Yuta, another member of the Blackpool Combat Club, defends his Ring of Honor Pure Championship against Daniel Garcia. I'm picking Garcia to win the title. I think that's going to be the lone title change on the show. That's my prediction. So again, I'll be live on YouTube when it's over. Ring of Honor did make an announcement this week about the status of its Honor Club streaming service. They are looking to expand it And while they work on those changes, there is going to be a pause on accepting new memberships. Current members will be extended at no extra cost until the new platform is launched in early fall. They said the subscription fee is going to be $9.99 a month. And this was the interesting line in the press release. New Honor Club content will become available 60 days after the events happen live. Now that could be in reference to their pay-per-views. And Bleacher Report, maybe it's, you know, they don't want those events to be made available for 2 months. It could be something as simple as that. Or it could be in reference to their new television show. If they have found a new network to be their new home, it could be that they're requesting a 60-day delay before they post any new episodes to the service. So maybe they're finally closing in on that elusive TV deal. We'll see. There's still been no announcement made by Tony Khan. Last week, I shared the latest update from Big E about his broken neck, that the latest scans show that his C1 is not ossifying yet or forming bone, and the plan is for them to take another look at it at the one-year mark, which would be next March. But otherwise, he was in great spirits, and physically, he's feeling great. Big E spoke further with ESPN and TMZ Sports about the injury, and he said that his neck will be evaluated at the 6 and 9 month marks, but his doctors don't think they'll have a clear answer on how long he'll be out of the ring for until he gets checked out at the 1 year mark. He said he did not suffer any displacement to his spine, nor does he have any spinal cord damage, ligament damage, nerve damage. He doesn't need surgery. He doesn't have any atrophy. He says he's been using a bone stimulator machine. He's gotten stem cell treatment. He's taking calcium supplements. And other than that, he's living a normal life, and he's waiting to find out if he'll ever wrestle again. He says right now it's just a wait-and-see thing. He doesn't know if they look at those scans next year and they say, well, maybe you should be doing something else with your life, then he may have to do something else with his life. But he says that he would be content if he never wrestles again. He said, my philosophy as a human being is learning to be content with whatever life brings you. I'm so grateful to not be in a wheelchair, but if I was, I would have to adjust to life in a wheelchair. That's just how I am programmed. If I spend hours or days or weeks kind of mourning where I'm at in life and life not being what I want it to be, that doesn't serve me. Worrying about it and stressing about it only hurts me. It's not useful. I think I'll be at peace with whatever happens. Whether I can wrestle again, I'll be at peace with that. If I can't wrestle again, so be it. My limbs work. It could have been very different for me. There's a lot of life to live regardless. He said he's also working out. He's down to 245 pounds. He wants to be even leaner than that. He said he's not as strong as he was before, but he is starting to show abs. He posted two photos on Thursday. He said he bumps into Dan Spivey at the gym all the time, and it always makes him smile. But until now, he can never work up the courage to go over and ask for a photo. But he finally did, and it's great. You can see Big E and Waylon Mercy. There's one photo where Spivey is smiling, and then another one where he isn't smiling. And he looks scarier now than he did when he was doing the Waylon Mercy gimmick. But anyway, he said Stone Cold Steve Austin and Kevin Nash are among the names that have reached out to him. Ridge Holland, who dropped him on his head, sent him a big package of red meat as a way to say that he's sorry. Big E doesn't eat red meat, so he gave the meat to a friend, and he said that his friend and his family had many nights of great feasts. But he has no ill will towards Ridge Holland for what happened. He wanted to make that very clear. In the meantime, he's been invited to take part in a WWE talent tryout for current and recently graduated college athletes in Nashville SummerSlam week. You know, there's lots of things that Big E could do for WWE if he can't wrestle again, if they won't clear him to wrestle again. But if he still wants to be part of the company, there's plenty of other things that he could be doing. I mean, maybe he could still be an on-screen talent. Maybe he could be a manager for the New Day. But he could do talent evaluation and recruiting. I think that's something I hadn't even thought of, given his background, background in athletics. That would make a lot of sense if that's something that he wanted to do. Commentary could always be an option. The man has options. But it all comes down to what those scans say at the 1 year mark. The 32nd annual G1 Climax kicked off this weekend, and it runs through August 18th. Usually the tournament has two blocks, the A block and the B block, but this year it has four blocks of seven wrestlers each, 28 men in total, round robin style, including Lance Archer. He is the lone AEW representative. Of course, Lance Archer spent many years in New Japan. He's basically still a New Japan guy. But he is the lone AEW representative in the tournament this year, with the winner getting the briefcase that allows them to challenge for the IWGP heavyweight title at Wrestle Kingdom in January. Okada won last year's tournament after his match in the finals with Kota Ibushi was stopped early due to injury to Ibushi. Ibushi has not wrestled a match since. That was almost a year ago. Last year's G1 ended in October, which is later than usual. So now they're back to their usual period in July and August. But I throw out my prediction for the G1 every year. This year is not going to be any different. So I'll break it down by block. Archer is in the same block with Okada. Both are in the A block, as is Jeff Cobb, Jonah, Bad Luck Fale, Toru Yano, and Filthy Tom Lawler. Jonah already learned this morning. I saw the results. Jonah already learned what it means to be Yano'd in the G1. But this is one of the easier blocks to predict. It's Okada. You know, Jeff Cobb, I have him. He has an outside shot of taking it. But I have Okada winning the A block. The B block is the easiest one to predict. We've got the IWGP champion, Jay White, Tomohiro Ishii, Tama Tonga, Tai Chi, Sanada, Great O'Khan, and Chase Owens. I'll be stunned if White doesn't win the block. The C block has Hiroshi Tanahashi, Tetsuya Naito, Hiroki Goto, Zack Sabre Jr., Kenta, Evil, and Aaron Henare. Tanahashi would be the safe pick, but Naito hasn't been doing anything. I mean, he's been on the back burner now for so long. I think he's got a big G1 showing in him, and I think that Naito takes the C block. And in the D block, we've got Will Ospreay, Shingo Takagi, Hiromu Takahashi, Juice Robinson, David Finlay, El Fantasmo, and Yoshihashi. This is the toughest one to call. It's either Ospreay or Shingo. Both of them are great in the ring. I mean, to be honest, I want the winner to come from this block. I'd love to see either Ospreay or Shingo win the entire thing. Someone who's never won a G1 before. Somebody new. Ospreay and Shingo are going to face each other on August 6th. It's a guaranteed match of the year contender, as all of their matches are. I think I had their best of the Super Juniors final in 2019 as my match of the year. If Ospreay wasn't carrying the U.S. title right now, I would probably have picked him to win the entire thing. But I think they may be trying to book a match with him against Shibata for Wrestle Kingdom. Or maybe that's just wishful thinking on Shibata's part. You know, after Shibata had that 5-minute exhibition with Zack Sabre at last year's G1 final, he said the next time we see him back in the ring would be in an actual match. Well, that turned out not to be true, since we just saw him at Forbidden Door and he didn't wrestle a match. But it's pretty clear he wants to wrestle again. It all comes down to New Japan clearing him. I don't know if they ever will. But it's possible they're planning something maybe with him and Ospreay. I'm still going to pick Ospreay to win the block, though. I still feel like he wins the D block. That then sets up Okada against Jay White, with Okada going over, I think. Naito against Ospreay. Ospreay wins. And we get Okada against Ospreay in the finals. That's my pick for the G1 final this year. I think Okada against Ospreay, and Okada wins. I know Okada wins, LOL, but I think Okada wins his second straight G1 climax. That would be his fourth overall in what is his 10th anniversary year with New Japan. You know, since he came back from Excursion and became an actual star, this is his 10th year, his 10th anniversary in New Japan. So it's not only the 50th anniversary this year for the company as a whole, but it's Okada's anniversary. And I think they go with their tried and true. I think they go with their tried and true draw for the main event of Wrestle Kingdom. You know, now he could always lose the briefcase to somebody before then. We saw that happen for the first time a couple of years ago when Jay White beat Kota Ibushi and he took the spot. Anything's possible. but I've got Okada winning the entire thing. Now a word from our sponsor, BetterHelp. Yeah, I hit the gym 4 times this week. A lot of you probably do the same, trying to take care of your body. But taking care of your mind is just as important. And I'll be honest, it's not something I really give a lot of thought to, not as much as I should. The way we take care of our minds affects each and every aspect of our day, so it's important to take the time to keep them healthy. There are lots of ways to keep a healthy brain, like learning a new language or taking power naps, but there's also BetterHelp online therapy. Having used BetterHelp before, I found it to be really helpful. That's why the word help is in the name of the service. The advice I received, though, I mean, it was very helpful to me. And if it was helpful to me, it can be very helpful to you, too. BetterHelp is online therapy that offers video, phone, and live chat sessions with your therapist. You don't even have to see anyone on camera if you don't want to. It's more affordable than in-person therapy, and you can be matched with a therapist in under 48 hours. I matched in even less time than that. I found it helpful just to have somebody to talk to and somebody who would listen. For some people, that may be the most important benefit to using BetterHelp. Our listeners get 10% off their first month at betterhelp.com/solomonster. That's betterhelp.com/solomonster. Brock Lesnar was back on Monday Night Raw this week for the first time since before WrestleMania. He said Roman Reigns has been living high on the hog since WrestleMania. He said pigs get fat while hogs get slaughtered. Which reminds me, we've got to get Brock out to our next hog show. He called Roman Reigns a hog and said that he slaughters hogs on his farm every day. At SummerSlam, the tribal hog is going to get a country shit-kicking, which apparently was written into whatever, you know, the dialogue was that WWE put together for the show. And they thought that it was fine, and then USA, I think, said it was fine, but then it was actually bleeped on TV, so there was some kind of miscommunication in there, I guess, between the two sides. Not very TV-14 of USA, considering it's supposedly their idea to bleep out the word shit-kicking. But he was interrupted by Paul Heyman, and then interrupted by Austin Theory after that, who again teased cashing in his Money in the Bank contract at SummerSlam. He also showed footage of Lesnar giving him an F5 off one of the pods in the Elimination Chamber match this year, to show him that he has not forgotten what Brock did to him. Chad Gable and Otis, they appeared at ringside. Theory told them to attack, but it didn't go so well for them. Lesnar destroyed them with chair shots. He hoisted Otis, who is no small man, up onto his shoulders with ease and gave him an F5 through the announce desk. Brock just knows how to be Brock. Brock is great at being Brock. And the fans ate it up. They loved it. In another era, Brock Lesnar against Chad Gable would have been a fantastic wrestling match. As great as those Angle and Lesnar matches were, Gable and Lesnar, I think, would have been great too. But that's not the same Brock Lesnar that we see in the ring today. This is a very different Brock Lesnar. 20 years ago, though, that Brock Lesnar against this Chad Gable, that would have been fantastic. We just celebrated 20 years of John Cena in WWE a few weeks ago. Next Monday, Raw is coming to Madison Square Garden, and we are going to be celebrating 20 years of Rey Mysterio in WWE. Same as John Cena, it's 20 years to the day that he debuted on SmackDown against Chavo Guerrero. The calendar worked out very well for WWE with these anniversaries. 2002 was actually a hell of a year for arrivals on WWE television. Brock Lesnar debuted, Randy Orton debuted, Batista debuted, although back then he was the Deacon. He was the Deacon Batista. John Cena debuted, Rey Mysterio debuted. So a lot of big names. And in terms of all-time GOATs, Rey is up there. I mean, just for his importance to smaller wrestlers, but the things that he could do in the ring, I had never seen anybody like him before. Yeah, I know he was already in ECW, he already had a name, but it was the exposure that he got working on TNT all of those years on Nitro that exposed him to just a much wider audience, and especially if you were somebody who didn't watch Lucha Libre, imagine seeing this guy for the first time in his physical prime flying around the ring like he did. Imagine that and not being impressed. I can't fathom it. This guy was unbelievable. But I also understand why you can't really call him the greatest luchador of all time. Some people get very upset about that. I definitely think he's in the conversation, but you know, yes, he did not have the cultural impact of an El Santo or even a Mil Máscara. Even I know how big of a legend El Santo and Mil Máscara was, you know, Blue Demon. I mean, you don't have to be a big Lucha fan to know just how huge these guys were back in their day. And Rey did not become a major star working in Mexico. He became a major star working in the U.S. So it feels weird to call him the greatest luchador of all time, or even one of the greatest luchadors of all time. But I mean, how can you not call him one of the? I mean, how can you not have him high up on the list? And to still be doing it today, 33 years after his first match, the style that he works, it's not like he's a very mat-based technical wrestler or a brawler who just punches and kicks. I mean, look at what he does in the ring. 33 years ago, he had his very first match. And look at the way he works, even with the bad knees, to still be out there at 47 years old, moving around the way that he does. It's why he is one of the greatest of all time. But he was in the ring with his son on Monday, face-to-face, with the Judgment Day. 1 week after the Judgment Day attacked him and his son in the back and left them for dead. They were kind enough to stand there in the middle of the ring and let them talk. It's ridiculous. Rey looked very, very dumb for not going after these two. Damian Priest said that Rey is done. He's got nothing left to offer his son. They're still offering Dominic a spot in the Judgment Day. A spot in a dying faction. It does not exactly sound like a very enticing offer to me. I mean, if this was the Four Horsemen, if this was the Hart Foundation, if this was DX, if this was the early NWO or something like that, I would say leave the old man behind and take the offer. But for the Judgment Day, Dominic would be better off joining Toxic Attraction. Balor said not only is Rey a bad leader, he is a bad father. And then finally Rey and Dom attacked. What followed was what the announcer said was a first time ever meeting between Finn Balor and Rey Mysterio. I don't remember the two of them ever having a match before, so I'll take them at their word on that. And it's too bad that this wasn't a bigger deal than it was. I know that Rey and even Balor, they're not as big of a, or they're not treated anyway as big of a star as they were many years ago, but there's still two pretty big names on the roster. I think more should have been made about this being, you know, their first ever match. It was just an unannounced match on TV with commercials. You know, we had two matches that were announced. Bobby Lashley was supposed to defend his U.S. title in an open challenge, and Riddle was supposed to wrestle Theory. And then late in the day, the show obviously got rewritten, and those matches suddenly weren't advertised anymore. But they gave away Balor and Mysterio unannounced. At least Balor won. The Judgment Day needs to start racking up some wins before Edge comes back and just destroys them all. Becky Lynch still wants another match with Bianca Belair. Looks like she's going to get one at SummerSlam 1 year after she came back and pinned Bianca in 26 seconds. Carmella beat Bianca on Monday by countout when Becky distracted Bianca and she did not make it back into the ring in time. Dumb babyface syndrome strikes again. She allowed herself to be counted out. Corey Graves on commentary called his wife a badass with a great ass. You see what I mean? They're already TV-14. Hasn't made the show any better. Bianca defends her women's title against Carmella again tomorrow night, and that should be the end of this. There's no reason to prolong this any longer. And they haven't set anybody up other than Becky Lynch for SummerSlam, so that's going to be the match. We had a 10-minute Miz TV segment with Miz and Tommaso Ciampa that was interrupted by AJ Styles, who made fun of Miz's tiny balls, which was then interrupted by Ezekiel. Followed by an 11-minute match with AJ Styles and Ezekiel beating Miz and Ciampa after Ciampa was disqualified for breaking up the calf crusher. He got into the ring to interfere, and it may have been his second time doing so, but he got into the ring to interfere, and he was disqualified. That is 20 minutes or 21 minutes of television time, all to get us to a cheap DQ finish that resolved absolutely nothing. That is a countout finish and a DQ finish in back-to-back matches for those keeping score. It's pretty clear they're stalling until they get Logan Paul back on the show tomorrow night. He's going to be on Miz TV. The reaction that he gets in Tampa tomorrow night is going to be very telling as far as how the live crowds are going to receive him as a babyface. And then something odd happened in the main event. It was Lashley and Riddle against Seth Rollins and Austin Theory. Randomly, in the middle of the match, they played Dolph Ziggler's music, and he walked to the... I felt like I was watching a cutscene in 2K22, where the screen goes black, and all of a sudden some random person comes walking out. Here comes Dolph Ziggler to the ring. He takes a seat in front of the announcers to watch the rest of the match. Corey Graves excitedly said, "He's back!" And I was puzzled by this, because I could have sworn that I just saw Dolph Ziggler in the Last Chance qualifier for the Money in the Bank match, that Battle Royal that they did, 2 weeks ago. So unless that was Dolph's evil twin, I'm not sure what the fuck Corey was talking about. Riddle was setting up later on for the RKO, when Rollins pulled Theory out to safety until Lashley speared Rollins through the barricade by the timekeeper's area. Theory got back in the ring. He tries to use the ropes for leverage on a pin attempt. Ziggler stands up, and he pushes Theory's feet off the ropes, which caused a distraction, which then led to Riddle hitting the RKO and pinning Austin Theory. As is tradition with Money in the Bank. They think that you have the briefcase, and so therefore you can just eat defeat on television every week, and it doesn't matter. It feels like Theory has taken more losses since winning the briefcase than he did in the months leading up to it. He lost on Monday, and he lost again on Friday. After the match, Ziggler got in the ring, he super kicked Theory, and then he stood over him with his arm raised high as they played his music. So, Dolph Ziggler is a babyface now. According to Meltzer, this is part of WWE's plan to give Theory a chance to work with somebody who can help elevate his game in the ring and give him some great matches, because that's the role that Dolph Ziggler has now settled into. That is now his job. Ziggler is never going to be the featured one. Not on the main roster, maybe in NXT, but he's not going to be the featured one. Theory, though, will be. We know Theory is going to be the guy. We know Theory is going to be pushed as the guy and pushed as a future world champion. You know, Ziggler had that run a few months ago as the NXT champion, and they used him in a similar way. He was working with Bron Breakker, and then they put the title match on Raw instead of doing it on NXT. That was when Braun won the belt back. Nobody gave a shit because hardly anybody watches NXT. But using Ziggler to work with the younger talents to help elevate them is probably, honestly, the best use of Dolph Ziggler at this stage. Going forward, it's going to be guys like Ziggler and Miz who play that role because they don't have people like Chris Jericho anymore. They don't have Kurt Angle. They don't have Kane or any of the other veterans that they would use and plug into roles like this. A lot of them are gone. They're retired or they're working somewhere else. The veterans now are Dolph Ziggler and The Miz and Sheamus. They're the vets now. There's just one problem. If Theory is going to work an extended program with Dolph Ziggler, I don't know how extended it'll be, but if he's going to work a program with Dolph, I mean, I don't really mind it, except that we're now 2 weeks away from SummerSlam. And all Theory is doing is going around and teasing that he's going to cash in on Roman Reigns or Brock Lesnar at the end of SummerSlam. Theory is not cashing in and winning anything if he's in the middle of a feud with Dolph Ziggler. So either it's a quick 2 week thing or Theory is not walking out of Nashville as the world champion. If he wins back the U.S. title from Lashley, that would make more sense for him to be working with Ziggler. But I would not take the U.S. title away from Bobby Lashley. So I think Theory tries to cash in, or teases it, but Dolph Ziggler is there to stop him and foil his plans. And that would allow Theory to hold on to the briefcase a little while longer, too. I don't really see a need for him to rush into cashing in when he's got a year. All these people, they're in such a fucking rush. Hold on to it for a while. I mean, I know it's annoying to have to carry that thing around, but my God, he's got a year. I think it would be too early to put those belts on him anyway. And if they feud, Ziggler can try to take the briefcase away from Theory. All right, if he stops Theory from cashing in at SummerSlam, they could have a match for the briefcase at some point. Ziggler can talk about, you know, cashing in Money in the Bank in 2013 to win the World Heavyweight title and how to this day it's the biggest moment of his career, the peak of his career, which is kind of sad, but it is. I mean, it's the peak of his career. And he sees young punks now like Theory coming in, passing him by, trying to take his spot. That used to be me. It should have been me, right? Something like that. Although I guess that's not a very babyface promo. But, you know, he needs that contract back. That's the story, I think. He needs that contract back to complete his redemption arc. So if they're going to tell this story, that's the way that I would tell it. There was a major angle that went down on NXT this week. It was a show-long angle involving the new NXT Women's Tag Team Champions, Cora Jade and Roxanne Perez. Show opens, and we see that Roxanne has been attacked. Where else? In the parking lot. The most dangerous place in America. Somebody has attacked poor Roxanne. She's on the ground. It's chaos. Everyone's running around. Cora Jade shows up. She doesn't know what's going on. Her partner is on the ground. And then as the show went on and Cora was interviewed in the back, it became very obvious. They were laying it on way too thick that it was going to end up being revealed that Cora Jade attacked her tag team partner. They certainly did not do anything that would lead you to any other conclusion. They made it pretty fucking obvious where this was going. And it built to the end of the show because Roxanne was supposed to come out and challenge Mandy Rose for the NXT Women's Championship. She had won the breakout tournament. She had a contract. And tonight she was going to basically cash in. It's like their version of Money in the Bank. And she was going to get a Women's Championship match. And now, of course, the question is Roxanne going to be able to compete? Is she going to be cleared to wrestle in the main event? We get to the end of the show. There's no Roxanne Perez. Here comes Cora Jade. And Cora is willing to take her place. How nice of her. She's willing to take her partner's place in the ring against Mandy Rose. Well, here comes Roxanne Perez, though. Ribs are all taped up. No, I'm going to wrestle. I'm going to cash in. I want to use my contract and, you know, let's do it. Let's have the match. And Cora says, okay. She stays ringside. She watches the whole thing. And so we're having Mandy Rose against Roxanne Perez. And then you can see it coming a mile away. She's outside the ring, and Roxanne is climbing back inside. The referee's back is turned. Cora attacks Roxanne from behind. Puts her in the ring. Mandy Rose hits her running knee strike. She pins Roxanne. She retains the NXT Women's Championship. Cora gets in the ring, and she is screaming mad. She is berating her partner. I made you. All these things. And Cora Jade picks up her skateboard. Of course, she always comes out with her skateboard. She's a skater girl. She picks up her skateboard. She raises it high above her head. And the skateboard breaks in half. This was unreal. The timing could not have possibly been it. I was going to say worse, but you know what? I'll say better. Because it was fucking hilarious. Picks it up before it even makes contact with Roxanne. The fucking thing splits in two. The gimmick, I guess the skateboard was a little too gimmicked. It wasn't cooperating. Nobody clued it in. Nobody smartened up the skateboard. So that was hilariously awful. And then she proceeded to beat down Roxanne with one half of the skateboard, and she was yelling at her as they went off the air. Now I look at this and I think to myself, what the fuck is wrong with these people? They just put the women's tag team titles on them a week ago, and all of a sudden they have split them up. And I'm not even saying the story doesn't make sense. It actually makes perfect sense. Cora Jade was the girl next door, right? She was the sweet girl. She was on the rise in NXT. And then Roxanne Perez debuted, and now she was the cute one. She was the, you know, the smaller woman on the roster who was taken in by the fans as a big baby face, and she had the sweet look and always a big smile on her face and all that. And she almost took the place of Cora Jade. So it would make sense that Cora Jade got jealous of all the attention that Roxanne was getting, especially when she won the breakout tournament. She had this championship match in her back pocket, and she couldn't stand it. She's young, she's immature, she was jealous, and she just couldn't take it. Right? She was tired of being the sidekick. That story actually makes sense. And when they rush something like this, this is NXT, so you have to consider the possibility that somebody is getting called up very soon. So they want to get the program done now before they lose one of them to Raw or SmackDown. Now, most of the time, that's complete bullshit because I'm sure the people in NXT, Shawn Michaels, whoever, they probably just get, you know, they get the word, hey, Vince wants to use so-and-so, you know, finish them up, they're done. And they probably don't tell anybody down in NXT. They just say, hey, we want this person. And they just pluck them out. I doubt there's a whole lot of forewarning when that sort of thing happens these days. But you have to at least consider the possibility that maybe that's what happened here. Maybe they knew that Cora was going to get called up and they said, well, we have to feud them now, right? But that's giving them the benefit of the doubt. Meltzer says that the turn went exactly as planned from the beginning. The storyline, the way they laid the whole thing out, was that they would win the women's tag team titles, and the very next week, Cora Jade would turn on Roxanne Perez. It worked out and played out exactly the way that they expected it to, save, of course, for the broken skateboard. The skateboard said, that don't work for me, brother. It had other ideas. So now we are in a situation here in this company where Sasha Banks and Naomi, they walked out on Monday Night Raw, that was 2 months ago, and they surrendered their women's tag team titles. When they did so, they were stripped of those belts. And at the time, WWE made the announcement that in the near future, we're going to have a tournament to crown new women's tag team champions. It's been 2 months, there has not been a single mention of the women's tag team titles on television, and evidently behind the scenes, there has not been word one said about any tournament or crowning any new women's tag team champions. Fightful just last week reported that the talent had heard nothing of if or when there would even be new tag team champions crowned, because they don't give a shit about the women's tag team titles on Raw and SmackDown. NXT has its own set of women's tag team belts. They took them off Toxic Attraction, they put them on these two, and now, 1 week later, they have broken them up. They are still technically the women's tag team champions. We will have to wait and see how they resolve this. Are they going to be forced to remain as partners and as unwilling partners and defend the titles? Are they going to be stripped? Is Cora going to surrender the title? We don't know yet. We'll find out on Tuesday what exactly they're going to do to resolve this whole situation. But now they have feuding tag team champions. So we have no women's tag team champions on Raw and SmackDown, and we basically are about to have no women's tag team champions in NXT. So the tag team scene when it comes to the women in this company, not very good. Not a very good sign, I think, for the women's tag team division in WWE as a whole. But I could, when I saw that, I mean, all I could do is help but just, I just laughed, right? I mean, I laughed a lot when I saw the skateboard botch. But when I saw that 1 week after putting them together as tag team champions, they immediately had Cora turn on her, I just, what do? You put your hands in the air and say, what the fuck? This is WWE, right? I mean, they can't help themselves. They can't help but break up teams. It's what they do. It's their favorite pastime. It's like a junkie trying to get their fix. They just can't help themselves. So that was the main angle coming out of NXT. I'm not doing a full review of the show because there's just not a whole lot going on right now. There's not a whole lot interesting, frankly, about the NXT brand. You know, they're trying to get some new names over. They're pushing some people. I enjoyed the match between Fabian Aichner and Apollo Crews. I was kind of surprised, actually, that they gave Fabian Aichner or Mr. Vinci over there, Da Vinci, whatever the fuck he is, surprised they gave him the win, but pleasantly surprised that they had Apollo Crews lose, but you had Zion Quinn interfering, so now that sets up Zion Quinn to feud with Apollo Crews. You know, Tiffany Stratton, they had some vignettes with her. She's, you know, improved a lot. You can see, you know, the people that they're really starting to focus on. Solo Sikoa and Von Wagner. I think they should put a mask on Von Wagner. You know, he's got the size, like one of those big guys back in the day who would come out and just do choke slams, you know. I think of a Kane, I think of an Abyss. Maybe that's what Von Wagner needs. Maybe he needs a mask. Put a fucking mask on his head. Maybe that's what this guy's missing. Anyway, that's NXT. WWE is back with a new season of biography specials on A&E. They aired the first one on The Undertaker last weekend. I haven't watched that one yet. But I did watch the companion series that they're running called WWE Rivals. It runs a little bit shorter than the biographies do. These are about an hour long. Each episode is going to cover a different WWE rivalry, which you can probably figure out from the name. The first episode covered the feud between Bret Hart and Shawn Michaels. Parts of it were enjoyable, especially showing them making up at the end after all the animosity. It's nice to see that they have, you know, buried the hatchet. They put the past behind them. And, you know, as Shawn Michaels was saying, you know, he and Bret, when there's a birthday or an anniversary or something, he'll get a nice text message. So they're not best friends or anything like that, but at least they patched things up enough to where they could be cordial with each other and friendly. And that's nice to see. But the episode was ruined by WWE's typical revisionist history bullshit. The format is the usual talking head interview spliced in with all the old footage, coupled with cutaways to a roundtable that was led by actor and former WWE writer Freddie Prinze Jr. He was sitting at the head of this, you know, small table. And the panel they put together for this was something else. They had Kevin Nash, Kofi Kingston, JBL, and Tamina as the guests. It's like they took my Be the Booker randomizer that I use on the YouTube streams, and they just picked four random people to throw out there. At least Nash had some connection to these two guys, even though we see him on screen here for all of 60 seconds, the entire episode. I think Nash said six words at the most the entire time. I'm sure he said more, but this is the footage they actually used. So that's the format for the show. The rivalry between Bret Hart and Shawn Michaels, I mean, we've talked about this before, it speaks for itself, right? These were two guys who have very similar backgrounds. They came up around the same time in that golden age period of WWF as part of a tag team. Bret was in the Hart Foundation, Shawn was in the Rockers, and they were on the smaller side. So at the time, it was the land of the giants in WWE, whether the Hogans and the Warriors and the Andres and Bossman and Akeem and just all these giant men, all these giant jacked up guys on the roster. Bret and Shawn were not exactly the biggest. But then as things started to change in the company and they had heat from the federal government on the steroid stuff, and all of a sudden guys' physique started to shrink and certain guys left the company and Hogan left and all these things were happening, Bret Hart was the chosen one. He was the one they put the championship on. They were going to usher in this new generation, this new era with him. Shawn turned on Marty, he went heel, and it was pretty clear they had big plans for him in the future, and they were going to be the future of this company. So that's, you know, their backgrounds were very similar. Two smaller tag team guys who were thrust into big singles pushes right around the same time as the company was changing. And they had quite a few matches together, not just with the Rockers against the Hart Foundation, but again, there's some forgotten matches that really don't get talked about as much as the bigger ones that they had. You know, they had that ladder match back in 92, which you could see on one of the Coliseum videos. They had a ladder match for the Intercontinental title. They had a championship match in the main event of Survivor Series in 92. So anybody thinking Survivor Series 97 was the first time we had Bret versus Shawn for the world title at a Survivor Series would be incorrect. And I remember the 92 match actually being very good. It was a very good main event. But, you know, obviously people think of the Montreal match, and they think of the Iron Man match or WrestleMania 12. And they dedicated a lot of time to those two things, especially the Iron Man match. They spent a lot of time on that and what a big deal it was. And, you know, 60 minutes. This had never been done at a WrestleMania before. They showed the training videos and talked about how they, you know, they tried to model it after the Rocky movie with Drago, Rocky IV. So they really got in depth on the whole Iron Man match stuff. But then they got into the aftermath, and they showed Shawn on his knees in the ring after he had won, telling Earl Hebner to tell Bret to get his ass out of the ring so that he can have his moment. Supposedly, that's what started a lot of the heat between the two of them. I don't know that I believe that. I think, you know, especially as time has gone on, I look back on it, I think that may have just been a seed planted for an eventual rematch between the two. But we do know that their relationship ended up souring when Bret came back. Now, if you want to know the real reason that things started going south between Bret Hart and Shawn Michaels, what went wrong? What went sideways between these two guys? By their own admission, the two of them had been very good friends up until that point for many years. They were pretty close. And so what happened? Where did it all go wrong? They didn't really get into this at all in the episode. But if you want to know the real reason where things started to go sour, it doesn't really get talked about. But in Shawn's book, he said that he had signed a deal with Vince McMahon in early 1996 for $750,000 a year. That's what he was making. He bumped him up to $750,000 a year. Vince told him at the time, this is the biggest deal in the company. You're going to make more money than anybody else in the company. And Shawn says that he told Vince, the only thing I ask is that you don't pay anybody else more than me, except The Undertaker. He said, Undertaker is separate. You want to pay him more, he deserves what he gets. But anybody else, it would be an insult if you paid anybody else more money than what you're paying me. And he claims that Vince agreed. Now, of course, Vince would agree. What else is he going to say? Right? He's the promoter. Promoters lie. That's what they do. So he said that Vince agreed. Then, when Bret came back and he signed that 20-year deal, all of a sudden, Bret Hart was making more money than Shawn Michaels. And Michaels was livid about that, because he knew that when Bret was away in 96 after the Iron Man match, later in the year, he had talked to Eric Bischoff and he was considering making a jump to WCW. And Shawn knew the WCW was starting to creep up on them and was putting a lot of pressure on the company, you know, and Shawn was the champion through much of 96. And he resented the fact that Bret Hart would negotiate, you know, with the enemy and possibly cross enemy lines. Which is funny to me because, you know, Shawn would have done the same thing. In 97, when Shawn, you know, there was a little issue there where Shawn had the fight with Bret in the back and he wanted to leave. He went to Vince and said, unsafe working conditions. I don't want to be here anymore. I want out of my contract. And Vince was basically like, fuck no, I'm not letting you out of your contract. You know that if he got out of his contract, the first thing Shawn Michaels would have done without hesitation is he would have gone to WCW to join his buddies. So it is kind of funny now to look at it from that perspective, but he was very upset. You're going to pay this guy more than me? When you told me that I was going to be the highest paid, this guy almost left. You're going to pay him more than me. So when he found out, he was furious. He had a meeting with Vince, the same meeting he had with Vince, where Vince pitched the idea of Shawn wrestling Bret in a rematch at WrestleMania 13, is the meeting where he brought all of this up to Vince, where he confronted Vince McMahon about it. Now that's a match that you have to know. You have to know that Shawn Michaels was thinking that he was going to be asked to do the job and return the favor to Bret, and Bret would win the championship. Now he's livid that Bret is making twice as much money as him, and Vince thinks that he thinks he's twice as good as me because he's paying him twice as much. When you realize that, it becomes very clear why Shawn Michaels suddenly lost his smile before WrestleMania, and the rematch with Bret never did happen that year at WrestleMania. But anyway, that's a little sidebar for you. That's really what got the ball rolling downhill between the two of them, and that's in their own words. They covered the promos in 97 between the two, Shawn talking about Bret calling himself a role model and making the comment, I've seen you on the road, Hitman, you ain't no role model. And then came the Sunny Days comment, which almost got Bret divorced. Bret says his son came home from school one day and kids were talking about this, and he said his son came up to him and said, hey Dad, what's going on between you and Sonny? So Bret was furious about that. They had their backstage fight. That was in June of 97. Bret pulled out a clump of his hair. I mean, you know, they covered all that stuff. Where the episode takes a nosedive, though, is the way that it covers the Montreal screwjob and Bret leaving the company. And I am as sick of talking about Montreal as I'm sure you are of hearing about it, but this was probably the worst retelling of the events leading up to it that I have ever heard. I mean, this goes beyond time constraints. Time constraints means that you may have to leave out small details to focus on the bigger picture, right? Time constraints, if that's what this was, does not mean that you blatantly lie and distort the facts, which is what they did here. They completely ignored the fact that when Bret came back at the end of 1996, he signed a 20-year long-term contract to stay with this company. He could have signed with WCW even back then in 96, and he did meet with Bischoff about it, but he opted to stay with Vince McMahon and take the longer deal because he never really wanted to go anywhere else. If Vince paid him good money and gave him job security, why would he leave? Right? He knows that he can wrestle as long as he wants. He's got this long contract. When he's done wrestling, he'll have an office position or an agent position, right? He had it made. He's comfortable there. His family works there. His brother-in-law. Why would he want to leave? All of this is completely glossed over. And what we got is people like Bruce Pritchard saying that, oh, after SummerSlam in 97, Bret's contract was coming to an end. Even though he had signed a 20-year contract the year before, his contract was coming to an end. Then they played a clip of Mayor Kane talking about there being a bidding war between WWE and WCW over Bret. So what it looks like they did here is they took clips of these people talking about Bret's negotiations with WCW in 1996, and they intentionally edited them here in this way to make it sound like Bret was playing both sides against the other in 97 and angling for the best deal while he was the WWE champion. The only reason that any of that even happened is because Vince McMahon had told Bret to go negotiate with WCW because he couldn't afford to pay him anymore. So yes, you could say that technically what they said is not untrue because there was negotiating going on and Bret was trying to get the best deal, but the way that they edited this and the way that they presented this, blatantly false, blatantly misleading. There's two explanations for what happened here, and neither one of them makes WWE or A&E look good. They either intentionally tried to mislead the audience because newer fans would have no idea about any of this. They would just take WWE's version of events at face value. They manipulated the footage to mislead people, or the people who edited this were so inept at their job that they ended up creating this alternate reality about what actually happened. I'm going to go with option A, because none of this shit makes the air unless WWE approves it. It's not like A&E is just going to do all of this on their own and WWE isn't going to have the right to look at it before it actually makes the airwaves. So that's what I think happened here. What they also didn't cover in the special, and this I can understand leaving out for time, but I think it's important to the story. In September of 1997, WWE had their very first live Monday Night Raw from Madison Square Garden. Vince McMahon came to Bret in the building that day, and he told him for the first time, he told him, the company cannot afford to pay him on his contract. We cannot pay you what we agreed to, and we are going to breach the contract that Bret had just signed less than a year earlier. And he gave Bret permission to go negotiate, gave him his blessing, to go negotiate with Turner, go talk to Bischoff, and try to negotiate a deal with WCW. And Bret was obviously hesitant about this. He didn't want to go do that, but he said, okay. He had a certain window, I think, right up until the very end of October. Vince was giving him that window to make a deal happen. So then the very next month, they're at the Nassau Coliseum. These conversations seem to always happen in New York. They're at the Nassau Coliseum, they're backstage, and Vince McMahon goes over to Bret and says, guess what? I can afford to pay you now. It's not a problem. Turns out that expanding the In Your House shows to 3 hours every month and raising the pay-per-view prices, I think they raised it by $10. Turns out that was a good business decision. It didn't chase off the viewers. It actually resulted in greater business for them. Now, all of a sudden, they had extra money so they could pay Bret. The problem is, he was already waiting for Bischoff to come back at him with his offer. And Bret wanted to know what Vince's plans were for him. He said, okay, that's all well and good, but tell me, what are your plans for me over the next, whatever, 6 months? Like, what role do you envision for Bret the Hitman Hart in your company now going forward? What's the plan here? Vince's great plan was you drop the title to Shawn at Survivor Series in Montreal, then you lose to him again in a four-way at the December pay-per-view, then you lose to him again in a ladder match at the Royal Rumble, but then on an episode of Raw, you promise that you're going to quit forever if you don't beat him in this one last match, and then Bret would finally win. Bret obviously thought that plan sucked. And then Bischoff came back to him with an offer for $2.5 million a year. And Bischoff is saying to him, what do I have to do to get you here? Is this good enough? What do I have to do to get you to sign this thing? And Bret said, well, Sometimes I don't get to the building until showtime, which Brett was notorious for being late. He said, sometimes I get to the building at showtime. And Bischoff said, done. What else? He said, well, with Vince, I have injury insurance. If I ever get hurt on the job, Vince covers it all. And Bischoff said, done. What else? And Brett said, that's it. And Bischoff said, we have a deal? And Brett said, yeah, we have a deal. And he got the contract on his fax machine. He signed it. And he faxed it back. And that was it. That was the end of Brett's 14-year run with this company. So again, the specific little details like that, I can understand them not getting into the weeds on all of it. But there is no excuse for them to air the show in the way that they did and edit the footage and manipulate the footage in such a way that makes it seem like Brett's the champion. He just got made the WWF champion. And now his contract is up and he decides to play the field and play both sides against each other just to get the best possible deal that he can for himself. Ignoring all of these other facts that I talked about. But this is what happens when you are working directly with WWE and retelling these stories, and the company is obviously working with A&E on this series. I mean, they're well done, they're well put together, but you have to assume that you're not getting all the facts. And if you're a newer fan, you don't know any better, you don't care. You think, oh, wow, what an interesting story. What a shitty thing for Brett to do. Right? There's going to be plenty of people who watch this and go, oh, now I understand why Vince McMahon did what he did. Now I get it. Don't even get me started on the whole, you know, we had to get the belt off Brett so that he didn't show up on Nitro with the championship. That's also still their fucking bullshit narrative. But one thing they did mention is what happened a month before Montreal. Once it's made official that these two are going to have a match, it's finally announced for Survivor Series, it's going to be Brett versus Shawn. Brett walks up to Shawn in the locker room to tell him that I'm going to be safe with you in the ring, I just want you to know, and you've got nothing to worry about. And I'm willing to put you over if that's what Vince wants me to do. I just want you to know that. Puts his hand out. And Shawn responds back to him that I appreciate you saying that, but I just need you to know that I am not willing to do the same for you. And he walks off. Brett has told that same story, hasn't changed. He's told that same story for years. Jim Neidhart was sitting right there when Shawn walked off, and Neidhart even said, I can't believe he just said that to you. Shawn in the episode says he honestly has no memory of that, but basically admits that he was a dick back then, and so it's entirely possible that it happened. If Shawn doesn't say that and actually responds like a rational person, and he turns to Brett and says, well, that's very nice, Brett, I appreciate that, and I'm willing to do the same for you, and he shakes Brett's hand, we're probably not talking about any of this right now. Montreal is not even a thing. And who knows how different things would have been. Maybe we never get, you know, the Mr. McMahon character, and you know, WWE definitely benefited, I think, in the fallout of Montreal, but it's one of those giant what-ifs. What if Shawn's response had been different on that day in that conversation? I don't think Brett ends up getting all bent out of shape about, well, I can't do the job to this guy, and so therefore I'm going to exercise the 30-day creative control clause that you agreed to put in my contract, which, again, is not mentioned anywhere in any of these retellings of any of these stories whenever WWE mentions this. But if they were stupid enough to allow that to be put in the contract, then they have nobody to blame but themselves. But Brett had a comment at the end of all this. He said, you know, it's a shame that things got off track with Shawn. We never really got to finish telling the stories that we could have told. Me and Shawn could have wrestled one time every year for the next 10 years, and they would have been the biggest matches of all time. He said, it's a shame that opportunity was squandered, probably by both of us. So they're able to reflect back on this and realize, you know, both of them realize that things could have been handled in a much better way. You know, they're older now. They have kids and grandkids. And, you know, that's what happens when you get older. You look back and you go, I can't believe I acted like such a fucking dick back in the day, right? And so it's nice to, like I said, hear them talking to each other as friends and getting along now. And it is strange to think that for all this talk about Bret Hart and Shawn Michaels, and it really is one of the greatest rivalries in the history of the company, they really didn't have that many singles matches together. Like when they were at their peak and their prime, they had the WrestleMania match and they had the match in Montreal. And those are really the only main matches that had any great significance that people remember. It's not like they had all of these pay-per-view matches, like John Cena and Randy Orton. They must have had probably 15 different matches, or Austin and Rock, or all. You think of the great rivalries, and I think Austin and Rock is actually featured on the next episode. They never really worked together, I think, as much as people might think. And it's very sad that things went down the way they did, because if Bret didn't leave, or even if Bret did leave, but then he didn't get hurt, he didn't have the concussions, he didn't have the stroke, he would have been back in WWE way sooner than he was. We could have gotten Bret Hart against Shawn Michaels. When Shawn came back for that second run, we could have had Bret Hart against Shawn Michaels at WrestleMania. Maybe, you know, WrestleMania 18. Imagine that. Because Bret's deal with WCW, I believe, was over in 01. They went out of business anyway. If Bret worked out something to come back, you could have had Bret versus Shawn in Toronto at WrestleMania in Canada. Or you could have had Bret against Shawn at WrestleMania 19 or 20 at Madison Square Garden. I mean, who knows, right? It's all, like I said, it's one big what-if thing. But the thing I always love about looking back on their rivalry, it's a shame it got, you know, they worked themselves into a shoot like they did. But what made it so great is, if you were watching as a fan and a viewer on television, you knew that these two hated each other. It felt real. It felt genuine, because it was. And that's, I think, has a lot to do with why it was so engaging to watch them go back and forth on television the way that they did. It was some of the most fun, frankly, watching on TV in 1997. To see Bret and Shawn, as petty as they could be, going back and forth in the way that they did, because you really believed that these two guys hated each other's guts. Two guys who thought that they were the best and their shit didn't stink. Bret thought he was the best. Shawn thought he was the best. Best against best, they elevate their game. And it's a shame that we never got to see it again. I don't know that, as Bret said, it would have been the greatest matches of all time, but I think they absolutely would have gone on to have some fucking classics. Look at what Shawn and Undertaker did in 2009. All those years later, they were so much older. It's one of my favorite matches ever. You don't think Bret and Shawn, a healthy Bret and Shawn, couldn't have had that same kind of match at a WrestleMania one year? If you have questions for the mailbag, you can email me, thesolomonster@gmail.com. Please include your name and where you are from when you write in. Let's dive into the giant sack that I have here in front of me, and we pull out a letter from Gilbert in Hanford, California. I love getting into my sack here on a Sunday morning. With everybody going back to WWE after leaving on good or bad terms, why hasn't Ken Shamrock returned for any reunion shows or the Hall of Fame? Not even a special on the network. Did something really bad happen? Your guess is as good as mine, even just as a talking head for like these A&E specials, right? Or something like that. He was a key player during that Attitude Era period. Why they don't use him, I don't know. I can only guess that he has made some comments over the years that really upset some key people there. I know he's made negative comments about Triple H. He's not a big Triple H fan. And so maybe that was part of it. And also, they just don't see any value in bringing Ken Shamrock back. He's almost 60 years old now. He's not the physically imposing fighter that he once was. That was his whole gimmick. He was the world's most dangerous man. He came out there, he looked like $1 million, ripped to shreds, and that Ken Shamrock is long gone. He was never a great talker, so it's not like they would bring him back for a speaking role to be a character on the show. I mean, he wasn't terrible, but it's not like, oh, we got to get Shamrock back, man. That guy's got the gift of gab. We can put a mic in his hand. Like, no, not really. I mean, his in-ring days are long over, but I think Shamrock still would have some name value as an inductee into the Hall of Fame. But he clearly got on the bad side of the wrong person or people in that company. Brett from Buffalo, longtime fan of the podcast. I've been rewatching Lucha Underground with a buddy of mine that is pretty new to wrestling, and it got me thinking about the company's relationship to AEW. Lucha Underground was the home for a lot of AEW stars like Rey Fénix, Pentagon, Sammy Guevara, Luchasaurus, Jake Hager, Jack Evans, Angelico, and plenty of other guys that came through the company. I think without Lucha Underground going under, we would not have had nearly as great of a roster for AEW when it debuted. Do you think that Lucha Underground going out of business affected the success of AEW, and how do you think AEW would have been affected if Lucha Underground remained operational? Well, first of all, Lucha Underground did not go out of business. It was not an actual company. It was a television show. It was a television show that was not renewed. But you're right, tons of talent on the current AEW roster got exposure through Lucha Underground. It was the first time that I became familiar with people like Penta and Rey Fénix, and Angelico, and Jeff Cobb, and Thunder Rosa. If Lucha Underground was still on the air, a lot of those people would be locked into long-term contracts, and AEW would have pulled talent from someplace else. I don't think it would have radically affected AEW taking off and being successful, and eventually they would have had... Look, they would have all migrated there eventually anyway. Contracts would expire, they would jump to AEW, and you'd end up seeing a lot of those same people in the company. So I think of the early days of AEW, you know, it would have looked a little bit different, but the key players who started that company, they would have all still been there. Kenny Omega, Cody Rhodes, the Bucks, Hangman, Jericho, Moxley, MJF, they all still would have been there. Neil from North Carolina, do you think Tully Blanchard will send the Gates of Agony after FTR, not just because they are Ring of Honor Tag Team Champions, but also because FTR fired him on TV? What do you think? I think that would make a lot of sense, storyline-wise. I think that as long as FTR is wrestling in Ring of Honor, why wouldn't Tully Blanchard want to get revenge on them for embarrassing him? Rocky Road from Detroit. What is your favorite secondary title of all time? And he says for him it would be the TNA X Division Championship. The concept and the early design, it just looked so badass. And the matches early on, like the Ultimate X, were always phenomenal. For me, it's the classic Intercontinental Championship. For me, you can't beat that late 80s through mid-90s IC title period. You know, the names that held it and used it as a stepping stone. Randy Savage, Mr. Perfect, Brett, Shawn, Rock. I mean, Perfect and Razor Ramon, they never held a world title in WWE, but, you know, I still think Perfect and Razor are two of the greatest to ever hold the Intercontinental title. When I think of the Intercontinental title design, when I get a picture of it in my head, you know, those are the guys that I think of first. I love that title. I love that title. I love that period. So in terms of the secondary championships, like the mid-card titles, it would definitely be the IC. Steve from Virginia. And we'll end with this. What is your personal favorite fan interaction? I am referring to fans of your podcast. And I had to think about this for a while. I've had a lot of great interactions over the years, but I loved the live sound-off that we did from Frankie's in Dallas. I mean, I had some help. It wasn't just me. I had Noah and I had Brian Blade with me. But we did that live sound-off from Frankie's in Dallas on the morning after WrestleMania 32. We had almost 200 people at 11 o'clock in the morning on a Monday watching me talk about wrestling, watching me do my thing. And then we took questions and we made it interactive. And then I got to meet everybody afterwards. I probably hung out there for 4 hours just, you know, meeting people and taking pictures and I lost track of time. I think I had to get to Monday Night Raw. I was like, holy shit, I didn't realize how late it had gotten in the day. And I had stuff to do before Raw that night. But I mean, as far as one-on-one interaction, I'd have to say crashing a Norwegian wedding in New Orleans WrestleMania 30 weekend is probably at the top of the list. And shout out to Marcus, if he's out there. He and his bride, they decided to tie the knot in New Orleans. And since his family lives in Austria and her family lives in Norway, instead of one side having to take the bullet and kind of be left out, you know, if they had a traditional ceremony, They just decided, you know what? We're going to get hitched on neutral ground and nobody is going to attend. And that way you wouldn't have one side feeling neglected over the other. So Noah, Mark, and I, we decide to show up to the church, this Norwegian church in Louisiana. We finished our hurricanes outside because we couldn't take them inside like a couple of degenerates. I'm like, why can't we take the drink inside the church? You could tell I'm not a church-going fellow. He's like, no, you can't bring it inside. So I finish my drink. We go into the church. And we ended up playing photographer for the ceremony, or I think Noah did, because they didn't have a photographer there. Again, there was nobody there. And eventually, when we were done, a few other people from our group showed up. And, you know, so it was nice. They at least had a few people there. But it was all very nice. And then outside the church, I interviewed the two of them and I reminded them of what Shawn Michaels did to Marty Jannetty. And I did not want them to end up the same way, as many couples do. But they are still together, happily ever after, I'm happy to say. So I would say that is probably the most memorable experience that I have had. As far as fan interaction, that is probably the most memorable. But I've had a lot of positive experiences. We've done a lot of meetups. You know, COVID killed that, but hopefully we'll get back to that at some point. But I've got some of the best fans. I appreciate you. Got a lot of positive memories. Hopefully we'll make many more. Right? We've only done 765 of these things. We've got at least another 765 left to go. Email me, thesolemonster at gmail.com. You can follow me on Twitter, @solemonster. Instagram, the handle is thesolemonster. And I'm going to be back with you next Sunday for episode 766 of The Solemonster Sounds Off. It is Ring of Honor, Death Before Dishonor weekend. The pay-per-view is on Saturday. But that's what I got for you guys. Plus, of course, live after Dynamite on Wednesday. Another brand new Sound Off Gamer going up this week as well. We'll be live on Friday night, as we always are, for SmackDown and Rampage. I got you guys covered. So be well. Stay safe. Enjoy your week. It's going to be 90 degrees plus here in New York, I think, every day this week. I literally think every day this week, going into the beginning of next week, it is at least 89 or 90. And I'm sure the real feel will be a hell of a lot more than that. So my only hope for this week, my only hope, my only wish for this week is that we don't have a blackout. We had a blackout here like 2 years ago or 3 years ago. I mean, forget all the groceries that had to be thrown away. I mean, that was just awful. When you had just don't have any power and you're in the middle of a heat wave the way we were when that happened, it is just fucking hell on earth. So I always get very nervous when the temperatures get this high and everybody's cranking the ACs. And I see what's going on in places like Texas. I mean, you guys got it even worse. I don't know if they're still doing rolling blackouts out in California, but I know in Texas, they're having a hell of a time with the power grid down there. So anyway, hopefully everybody stays safe and stays cool wherever you are. And I'll see you back here for 766 next Sunday. Until then, take care, guys.
The Solemonster Sounds Off.
There are too many titles on AEW television. They're not even all AEW titles. Ospreay came out to the ring. He had his Rev Pro heavyweight title. He's in the ring wrestling one half of the Ring of Honor Tag Team Champions, who also just so happens to be one half of the AAA Tag Team Champions. Later tonight on this show, Jon Moxley and Hiroshi Tanahashi are going to go face-to-face ahead of their interim AEW World title match. Miro is going to wrestle Ethan Page in a qualifying match for the brand new All-Atlantic Champion. We also had an appearance on this show by Jeff Cobb and Great O'Conn, who are the new IWGP Tag Team Champs. Thunder Rosa came out, pulled up her AEW Women's Championship. Jade Cargill is having an open challenge on Friday for the TBS title. Did I miss anything? The Owen Hart belt, the FTW belt. It's too much. It's too much.
The Solemonster Sounds Off. Each week, bursting with content. Podcasts, predictions, reviews, YouTube live streams, and more. Become a channel member for perks and follow The Solemonster on Twitter @Solemonster.
Solemonster.
Solemonster.
Solemonster sounds off.